well enough? Okay. I'm also not going to use slides, so. Yeah, so. Yeah, okay. Is this better? Yep? Okay. So Liam gave us these two examples and some general points about XML as a data format and some of the details about data formats. I'm not going to do the example that I had thought I might show. I would actually ask if people are interested to approach me and maybe we can do something either in the evening or during an afternoon where there's some time. I've done some work with the data from the FRESS project at Brown. This was a hypertext system largely implemented in 1970 and probably feature complete by 74. And it was used in the first course in poetry taught on a computer by Robert Scholes. And there's actually a paper describing that. I have all that data because I happened to be at Brown and to know people. And so I have the course and I have actually a 370 emulator so I can run FRESS on my Mac and I can and I've also done some data format conversion. So all of the strategies that we've talked about, I've done something with it, and it'd be interesting to talk about it, but there's not time for that here. The boundary between the code and the object and the data that drives it is a difficult one, and so I'm going to... I had thought of doing technical details or even, you know, some of the recommendations, but the reports are all going to be public. I don't think that's the way that I want to do it. I want to talk more to the writers about what you would do and why here. And the point that's resonated with me throughout my involvement with this project is really from the arts and sort of in the same way that Matt Kirschenbaum was taking point at. Ideas from textual studies, some ideas from art got me. And I would say that this is the notion of archival materials and you know what we do over time. I occasionally do a little bookbinding, and one of the things you do as soon as you learn about bookbinding is they tell you about paper, and then they tell you about glue, and they tell you about what kind of processes you should use so that the book won't just fall apart on the shelf from the physical structure. You want to make sure everything's not acid, and so forth. And that's just something that you learn. It's part of what you're taught. Nobody makes you use archival materials in books. I'm an amateur. I don't bother with a lot of things. When you train as a painter, you learn about pigments, and you learn which ones are color fast and which ones aren't, and what's toxic and what isn't, and what kind of canvas and how to prepare it. So artists don't accept a standard for their work. Nobody says this is what a standard painting will be like. But they do accept some information about if you choose to draw your pictures with cheap felt tip markers that you buy from the store, you may have blank sheets of paper in 15 years. And I know people that this has happened to. You know, they didn't think about it and they came to regret it. So it's... So I think that the ELO sort of has a role in helping to create archival materials for writers. And I came up with an analogy. Sort of amateurs just buy stuff at the art store, and they don't worry about what the material is. And sometimes it lasts, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes that's a bad thing. I think in new media, we're all amateurs in the sense that there's no accepted knowledge, there's no accepted set of practice that's known to writers and artists in new media, and there is not a group that is promulgating some information so that people who want to cater to that market can do it. I mean, I heard a number of comments about story space and some of the difficulties of having your files trapped in a commercially owned format which isn't accessible, and also, you know, the market there is small, and maybe that's not the market that you want, and what do you do? Well, of course, if there was another format involved, you could do something. And I thought it was interesting that Mark Bernstein's new product, Tinderbox, uses an XML file as its basic data format. And, you know, this occurred to me that's the first of Mark's programs that I've actually used. And the thing that was great is I hadn't figured out how to do a text export from it because it's kind of tricky. And I had to present slides from some Tinderbox notes. I wrote a little style sheet in XSLT, and this was the second XSLT style sheet I'd ever written, and made an outline in HTML for a presentation at a talk that I had to do. So it was very nice that my data immediately could come out of this system. Now, if I'd wanted to take something very complicated, it would have been hard. And it has agents and predicates and, you know, features which would take work to extract. But the truth was, all my words were there, and I could get them out. So we're dealing with something a little more complicated now. We have a computational component. The question is, what do we do? How do we deal with that boundary? That is, all of the things that we've seen, you know, there's scripts, there's graphics, there's animation. What we want is a format that will let someone later inspect and reevaluate that. And for the most part, the commercial tools that are available are like art store supplies. Flash is not a format that's going to live for a long time. It's going to be increasingly difficult to run old Flash files. I mean, you know, they support all the versions right now, but you know that that's going to happen. Unfortunately, there aren't comparably powerful tools in existence. You can do some of the graphic rendering things you can do with Flash and SVG, but you can't do the interactivity, and if you do it, you have to do it by means of custom programming, which again will immediately have that lifetime. So you have an algorithmic component, and what do you do? Well, there's a few practical things. One is represent your data in XML if at all possible. Demand from sellers of products that they give you some kind of an import and some kind of an export in XML. This is a place where Microsoft is doing a great service to the computer industry, one of the few. They're pushing XML really hard. They're pushing it in their Office products. They're pushing it in a lot of things. So that there actually is starting to be a trend towards this kind of imported export being widely available. But that's worth an awful lot to you. Even if you're writing custom code, you can put your data in XML. The example of Raptor is an interesting early e-literature example. The code is just a horrible mess. People have tried to look at it and figure out what Raptor does. And it's pretty darn impossible. I mean, it's just squirrely and horrible. But there's also a directory full of Raptor definition files in a kind of odd syntax. But you can look at those, and you can see a lot of the kinds of structures that went into the creation of those algorithmically generated texts. And you could re-implement Raptor far more easily than you could figure out the dialect of BASIC that it was written. It is BASIC.
Prolog.
Oh, it's in Prolog? Even worse. So I would say that there are two archival materials that we've got right now. One is XML, which is a good way to notate the structure of the textual components or the data that's input to your programs. If it's declarative, and at the moment I would say the thing to do is probably hang on just a little bit longer and the exports will be there. But go back to bookbinding. It's kind of like if you're making books, there's wonderful commercial paper available, most of which is not safe. If you really want fancy paper and a book that will last, you may have to learn how to make paper. And right at the moment, we still have to make some of these tools, or you have to hook up with someone who does, so you have to find technical assistance to do that. But I think that kind of assistance is available. Nope. 3 minutes is good because I have no more than that. The other archival material is that you have a program. You're writing something, you know, it has behavioral context. And there, what you should do is pick a programming language, if you can, that's standard and popular and well-defined and as small as you can get away with, because those are the things that will make it last. If you happened to be writing programs in the 70s in Lisp, you could probably re-implement the environment that you had in a modern Lisp in a day or two. If you were writing them in Jovial or JOS or some of the other strange languages that were mentioned before or Track, you're going to have a lot harder time because they're not so well documented. They were never popular and they're hard to build. But that's just a guess. And then that program should be written so that it's as easy to read as possible, so that if somebody has to re-implement it, they can actually read it and understand what's going on. You know, these are simple things, almost obvious things, but things that people don't always think about. And some levels of behavioral stuff can easily be encoded into XML and other declarative formats. So graphic pictures are often described as a program to draw the graphic, but a format like SVG lets you declaratively describe what the objects in that graphic are. And so those kinds of formats are available. The same thing's true with VRML. If you want to do 3D models, VRML is a good format to put them in because at least somebody can look at all of the bits and bytes. But if you save your Strata 3D binary file, well, Strata's still in business, but you know, it might have been the Mac OS 9 version. You might not ever be able to get the data out again. So thinking about these things is really important. And that's it. I mean, I think that the ELO's goal is to start to define the primitives that will let software companies say, okay, well, we want to help these guys preserve their Flash, but we need to tell them what kinds of interactivity go into the XML and what into the programming languages. I think that's the work, that's the technical work that we didn't talk about because it doesn't fit here and also it's not done. But for people who are writing, I think that there's a lot of utility coming out, and while we will look retrospectively, because you always support what you already know how to do much better than what somebody else is going to come up with, doing that gives us, I think, the best way forward. If, you know, at least node-link hypertext should be represented in a standard format that anybody can read into any program that does that kind of thing. We understand that well enough now. And lots of kinds of interactivity are also probably understood well enough now that we can do it. And I think that all of the other things, I mean, Howard's comments about documenting the performance of the work or particular instantiations or stages, that's exactly what you do when you work in non-archival materials. So Christo never thinks that, you know, the running fence is going to last. He knows that, you know, the pictures of it are going to last for a long time afterwards. And that's a perfectly acceptable strategy in art. It hasn't been a strategy in writing because publishers do that for you now. But as you seize new materials, you also seize new problems. And so that's it.
Next up is Nora Wardrop Fruin and John Hewis and Robert Kendall. I want to mention that Nora was in charge of what we internally in our committee called the Products Development Group. That's a kind of a bad joke, I suppose. This is a group in charge of brainstorming tools and applications that might be built to these specifications. Nora?